On July 12, 1987, a boat known as the Amelie landed on the south shore of Nova Scotia, carrying 173 passengers seeking refugee status in Canada. Most were Sikhs fleeing violence and persecution in India. They risked a long and difficult journey to seek safety. Upon their arrival, however, these refugees faced hostility from the Canadian government and much of the Canadian public. This is the story of the boat people aboard the Amelie, and the people whose lives were touched by their journey. However, it is also a story that extends long into the past and into the present. The arrival of the Amelie is just one event in a long history of people taking incredible risk to migrate to Canada. With the arrival of 492 Tamil refugees in British Columbia 2 years ago, it is obvious that the history of boat people continues to this day. By telling the story of the Amelie, we hope not only to share an interesting piece of history, but also to illuminate the connections between past and present, and dispel some of the myths about migration and the Canadian immigration system. In doing so, we show our support for the struggle of boat people, past, present, and future.
It is July 12th, 1987. A thick fog, unusual for this time of year, has been hanging over the south shore of Nova Scotia for days, providing the ideal cover for a series of strange events. Rumors have been circulating about the arrival of a large ship carrying migrants off of Canada's east coast. After the arrival of 150 Tamil migrants near Newfoundland a year earlier, the government is uptight about the possibility of yet another unofficial arrival of migrants to Canada. A close watch is being kept along the Atlantic coast by the RCMP. Nevertheless, a 497-ton freighter manages to float ashore unnoticed, near the small town of Charlesville. The ship is known as the Amelie, and has sailed from the Netherlands carrying 173 men and one woman. Though a few are Muslim, the passengers are overwhelmingly Sikh fleeing persecution in India.
The weather is fog. 4 days continues. Nobody knows his ship is coming because of fog. After landing in around before 10 o'clock in night, ship is moving. After 2 hours, weather is clear and the moon shine.
This is Avtar Singh Sandhu. He lives with his wife in Caledon, Ontario. They have two children and some farmland they hope to work now that he has fully retired his construction company. Like many of the other passengers who arrived in Canada aboard the Amelie, Mr. Sandhu is a practicing Sikh from the Punjab region of India, an area that was plagued by sectarian violence during the 1980s and early 90s. Like most ethnic or religious conflicts in India, the conflict between Sikhs and Hindus bears the imprint of India's colonial past. Using a divide-and-conquer strategy, the British set religious and ethnic sects against one another. When India won independence in 1947, these conflicts intensified as the South Asian continent was carved up without full consideration of how the new borders would affect the people who lived within them. Sikhs are a minority in India, but in the Punjab, their numbers are strong. Many Punjabis feared that their unique language and culture would suffer under the centralizing policies of the Indian government. With these concerns in mind, the growing Sikh nationalist movement, known as the Khalsa movement, called for the creation of an independent Sikh state in the Punjab territory. In the mid-1980s, the tension between Khalsa supporters and the Indian government culminated in bloodshed. Economically disadvantaged and fearing persecution, thousands of Sikhs fled India.
I started in May 6, since 1985. Then I go to East Germany. In Berlin, 1 month I stay over there. Then after I go in West Germany. Around 1 year I stay over there. Then after I go to in Holland. After I try to one time go to in England, then I deport to over there, then come back again in Holland. Then I try to buy this ship. I come in 87, July 12th in Charles Bell.
Like Avtar, who went first to Western Germany, then to Holland, most of the Emily's passengers had spent time working and living in Western Europe. For so many of these passengers, the voyage on the Emily was a last resort. After years of precarious living in refugee camps, they would make an incredibly risky voyage to Canada.
You know, I have to make a refugee claim. I think maybe not a good over there. Because in Canada is a good country. They not send it to back in India. They have to accept it, refugee. So I have to make a refugee claim. That's why I stay here.
This is Nirmal Singh Chahal. He lives in Moulton, Ontario, with his wife and children, and has recently retired from his job at a furniture factory. Like many of the other passengers aboard the Emily, Nirmal was an adult when he arrived in Canada. He left his wife and young children in the Punjab and set off in pursuit of a safer, more stable life, free of persecution. This is Chahal speaking about his young adulthood, after he and his wife are married.
Before we go 3 years in Iran, when we married, my bigger son is that time is only 14 days. Then I left and go to Iran. 3 years after go back in country, couple months after go to Germany, then they send the back. Then I come back, go to Lebanon, and too many countries. Too hard, you know, set up the life.
Looking for work and the possibility of citizenship, Chahal traveled from country to country while his wife and young children remained in the Punjab. He met Sandhu and the other passengers of the Emily in a refugee camp in Holland, where they also met the men who would arrange their passage to Canada.
You know, people, I hear, you know, like, go to Guru temple. So that guy have to go around over there, where the too many people live over there, the refugee people, right? The guy go there. He told like that, who want to go in Canada, go with me, I take you over there, right? So this way I decided, after he go to temple, he pray there, he say, I am not lie, I take you there. Otherwise, you know, this ship is very bad, very small, so nobody believe this ship is coming here.
Most of the passengers knew the risks they would be taking aboard the Emily. This was a small boat, a decommissioned boat, that was only built to hold 50 passengers. On this voyage, however, human cargo was 174 passengers, plus crew.
It's very tough. Around 8 days, I don't know, I am going to further and behind, I don't know. It's too much sea bad. Everybody no good eating, everybody throwing, you know. That's why it's lots of problem. 8 or 10 days. After little slowing, and the ship condition is very bad. Inside is the bad smelling. Everybody is sick like that. That's why late journey is just three people saying 13 days. I reach over there in 19 days.
Due to inclement weather, the voyage took almost a week longer than expected. As they neared Nova Scotia, heavy fog made it impossible for the Emily's crew to see the shoreline. They hovered at sea until the fog cleared enough for them to see the shore. The passengers used emergency slides to disembark in shallow waters while the boat headed back towards the open ocean. Not knowing exactly where they were or what was going to happen next, the passengers waded out onto land, uncertain even of what country they had landed on.
Know that where I have, in USA or in Canada? Because I don't know, in Canada or USA. That's why his people over there are very scared. He never see like that kind of people. You know, some people is turban guys. Some people like normal. And that's why very confused. I am confused too.
Faced with darkness and a strange land, many of the refugees wandered out into the highway in a state of confusion, alarming some of the Charlesville residents.
I am landing the night time, around 9:30, touch the land. Then between half an hour, everybody is land. His shipping guy, the captain say, you stay a couple hours here, then you move it, because he moving. 5 o'clock, I try to come in the road. Then I come road, then I see the houses. Then I meet one truck towing guy. He very scared. The different kind of people come in Charlesville. I never see that like that kind of people. He scared, he run away.
The population of Charlesville was instantly doubled with the boat's arrival. Most Charlesville residents had never seen or met any South Asian people before that morning. And it was equally likely that this was the first time the Sikhs had met any Canadians.
At that time, no one seemed to really want to, was interested in them. They thought they were a bunch of dirty people, I guess. But they weren't. They were on a boat for 17 days. And they had left, I think, in Germany or and they were on a boat for 17 days in the hold of a boat. They went through a lot of hard times. There's no bathrooms, no nothing. And that many people in the bottom of a boat. And then the boat broke down at sea, and they had to get some of those people to repair the engine to get it going again. So they never had it easy.
This is Vernon Malone, a resident of Charlesville who was among the first Canadians to greet the refugees. He is fondly remembered by the migrants for the help that he provided, and continues to have a relationship with many of them.
Then Mr. Malone see so many people, then he come take the camera. He say to please, it's very dangerous on the road, you know. Every people come in my lot. Then he help us juice, breads, like that.
I wasn't afraid. I went to the highway with my movie camera and took pictures. And I wasn't afraid. I don't know why. I'm just not afraid. But they were just afraid that, I don't know, I suppose. They didn't know. And it was strange that many people would be in the highway. And the RCMP came and asked shortly after that and told me to leave. You know, I said, let's get them out of the highway because they're going to get run down. It was thick fog and dark. And he said, you go home and mind your own business, and we look after the people. Anyway, I guess I could have been arrested because I told him one guy could talk pretty good English, and I just told him to follow me to come to our property, you know, so they wouldn't get run down in the highway.
Now that the RCMP had learned of the migrants' arrival, they began to organize a way to transport them to a detention center in Halifax. In the meantime, many of the residents of Charlesville were organizing to help the migrants. Kulvinder Dillon, who was president of the Maritime Sikh Society when the Emily landed, recalls.
And there was a lady who helped them the first meal, and they kind of put them in a fire hall, which is a normal community center in any Canadian town, if you call it. And then I think there was a lady who, she kind of told their own volunteer group that we have to feed these people before they go to Halifax because there's almost a 3-hour drive or something like that. So they called them the peanut butter lady because she knew that they are mostly vegetarian. So all she could think was peanut and sandwich and juice, I guess.
Despite the language barrier, many of the residents and the passengers hold many memories of that first interaction. A favorite story shared by the passengers of the Emily and the people of Charlesville is the one about the passenger who asked for a taxi to Toronto.
Because they did not know where they were. They didn't know, they thought they was in, supposed to be landed in Toronto. And they asked for, you know, a taxi to go to Toronto. They thought they were close. And anyway, after a while we told them they were a long ways from Toronto. And then my sister, officer and all the community got together and came in and brought food, different things like drinks and stuff like that. So we gave them water. Anyway, we helped them.
The story of Vernon Malone and the Peanut Butter Lady are found in many of the newspaper reports describing the arrival of the Emily. These individuals became symbols of Canadian hospitality in Charlesville. Unfortunately, the warm welcome the migrants received in Charlesville would not be echoed by the Canadian government.
Yeah, they want to send back.
That time I am worried.
Land of dreams, come and pay. Free, free, free. Raise your families. Promises, promises. Promises, promises.
Unable to find a detention center large enough to hold all 174 of the passengers, the migrants were transported in yellow school buses to a Canadian Forces base in Halifax and detained for supposed security reasons.
Done over there. I living around 20 days, 3 weeks almost, because he sent the inquiry to India because no have paper, no nothing. I have no information by the paper, no nothing. That's why. Because he find it, where he come from, who is person, you know. That's why he send the inquiry back to India. That's why he take 3 weeks.
Conditions at the detention center were sparse. The refugees were confined to a single room, where they slept on mats on the floor and there were no chairs. The security was strict, and military police patrolled the area carrying batons the size of baseball bats. This is Mendel Green, a Toronto-based immigration lawyer who represented the passengers immediately after their arrival.
When I went to Halifax, to the detention center, and these people were put under strict military detention in an army barracks because there was no jail big enough to keep 174 people, they wouldn't let me speak to the people. They wouldn't even let a priest go in and offer prayers for the people. These people were kept like they were, you know, murderers. To be very frank, the security was so strict, and it sounds, you know, comedic now, but I couldn't go to the bathroom in the military base without being escorted by a sergeant of the Canadian military and, of course, an ordinary soldier. And they stood outside my washroom door to make sure that I didn't go the wrong way. So it was unfathomable from my perspective, and don't forget we're talking 25, 28 years ago, that my government, the Canadian government, could react in this volatile, and to be very frank, I think not in a credible way. I lost great faith in the government process.
Green was hired by the Sikh communities of Toronto and Vancouver to argue for the release of the refugees from detention and to ensure that they received the procedural rights they were due as refugee claimants. Upon their detention, the migrants were not fully informed of their legal rights and were denied access to legal counsel for the first 4 days of their confinement.
I asked for an opportunity to speak with the Minister of Immigration in those days and to try and resolve it in some business-like way so that we didn't have to go through all this nonsense. They refused to talk to me. And they delayed my right to even interview my clients. Everything was against these people. The whole country was against these people.
The Emily was certainly not the first ship of migrants to be treated harshly by the Canadian government. Avi Goh, director of the Metro Toronto Chinese and Southeast Asian Legal Clinic and a member of the now-defunct Coalition for a Just Refugee and Immigration Policy, explains.
I think there's a myth that Canadians had long been supportive of refugees and immigrants, but if you know anything about history of Canada, you will know that that's not true. So I think that while there is a common myth that Canada had in the past or, you know, have always been welcoming of immigrants and refugees, but in effect, the laws that we chose the laws that we passed through the representatives that we elected have never been that welcoming, in my perspective.
In 1914, a ship known as the Komagata Maru arrived in Vancouver carrying 376 mostly Sikh passengers fleeing India. Though they were all British subjects, Canadian officials refused to let the ship dock, and the passengers were denied food and water during a two-month standoff in the Vancouver harbor. Upon their return to India, the ship was taken by a British gunboat, its passengers held prisoner. Gunfire eventually broke out, killing 20 of the passengers and wounding 9. In 1939, 907 Jewish passengers aboard the SS St. Louis met a similarly horrific fate. Fleeing the horrors of the Holocaust, the St. Louis approached Canadian shores. Prime Minister Mackenzie King famously declared that this was not a Canadian problem, and an immigration minister later seconded this position, stating that none is too many when it came to Jewish refugees. They turned the ship back to Europe, where many were to perish in gas chambers and crematoria.
Because to be very frank, if we save one life, it's like saving the world. And to be very frank, this is what concerned me, because in this particular instance, at that particular time in history of the world, these people had legitimate claims to refugee status and were fleeing the Punjab just like the passengers on the St. Louis. There was no difference. And our country overreacted.
These monstrous histories formed the backdrop to the 1987 case.
The question of refugee policy was a growing concern in Canada at the time of the Emily's arrival. Elected on a ticket of reducing national debt, Brian Mulroney's Conservative government had chosen the cumbersome refugee system as a target for neoliberal reforms. It was no surprise, then, that the story of the Emily dominated the country's newspapers for weeks.
I think it probably was the biggest media blitz that Canada had ever seen. There were virtually 50 to 75 media representatives from all over the world in Halifax.
Atlantic Canada had been getting quite a bit of attention since the previous summer, when a similar incident occurred in Newfoundland. However, the 150 Tamil refugees who arrived at that time were spared the worst excesses of the Mulroney government. The bitter irony is that at the same time as Mulroney was granting special ministerial permits to allow the Tamils to stay in Canada, his ministers were taking steps to ensure that such generosity would not become standard practice.
Before me, one Tamil chief is coming. Government gave the land right with that paper, right? That people. So why Indian people are coming in? Why not get that right with that paper, right? When I come next year, right, 87, so they say I want to send to back, you know. Why not that people send to back before?
The government's reaction to the Emily reflected an alarming trend that had been emerging in Canadian refugee policy. At the time of the boat's arrival, Bill C-55, a contentious new bill proposing huge reforms to the refugee claim system, was at its second reading in the House of Commons. Perhaps the most controversial feature of the bill was the Safe Third Countries provision. This stated that if a claimant arrived in Canada from a designated third country, the government would be able to deport this person back to the country they had arrived from. This is Peter Scholler, former chairperson of the Immigration and Refugee Board and director of the Refugee Forum at the Human Rights Research and Education Center at the University of Ottawa Law School.
The logic is, if you come through a country that is safe, by safe it means that it has a reliable and a viable refugee system, then if you're really a refugee, you should claim there. But that is sort of the logic of officials, it's the logic of the public, but it's not in the law, and there's nothing preventing a refugee claimant from coming to another country of sanctuary as long as they're a signatory to the convention. And let's face it, it's quite reasonable if people really thought about it in their own situation.
The government claimed that safe third country provisions were intended to weed out false refugee claimants and so-called haven shoppers. However, advocacy groups, such as the Toronto-based Coalition for a Just Refugee and Immigration Policy, believe that the provision was intended to discourage refugee claimants in general. A.V. Goh was a member of the coalition at the time.
And Canada, in a way, it's partly because of our geographical location, it's just simply harder to get to Canada, right? And that's why I think the Safe Third Country provisions is put in place, because we know that most of the refugees who come here have to come here through another country first.
The merits of Safe Third Country regulations were a big part of the debate surrounding the Emily migrants. Almost all the passengers had traveled to Canada via Holland or West Germany. Fearing a negative reaction if it were found out that the passengers had come through Europe and not directly from India, many of them hid or destroyed their passports upon arrival.
And they are in Nova Scotia. I was in a scare. I don't know what happened. You know, the police coming there, so army coming there. I say, I don't know what happened. You know, and then all people say, oh, put a passport. There's some people scratch the passport and throw it in the water. I have to put over there. And two, three people help me. Wrap up the plastic and put underneath in the
When people learned that most of the claimants on the boat, the refugee claimants, had actually been living in Europe for a considerable period of time, there was a huge reversal in public perception of the validity of the claim. So that was one of the concerns. But the other concern was, and this is quite important, is there was a presumption that the Dutch and the Germans and the other European countries had viable, fair asylum systems. And the truth of the matter is, even at that time, that they didn't. That they really often did not give someone a fair hearing. And that's literally why several of those claimants on the boats, they were desperate. Many of them weren't getting any decision at all. They were left in temporary circumstances and with a concern that they would ultimately have their claim denied. So they decided to try their chances in a country where they thought they could get a fairer hearing of their refugee claim.
It was assumed that Germany and the Netherlands would constitute safe third countries, even though they had stricter refugee policies than Canada. For the passengers of the Amelie, being sent back to Europe increased the likelihood of deportation to India and persecution in their homeland.
All of them had serious concern about the situation in the Punjab, and at that time, shortly after the execution or the murder of Mrs. Gandhi, there was terrible turmoil in the Punjab, and these people all had credible and reasonable and arguable refugee claims. And to be very frank, I became quite emotional about it because I'm Jewish. I knew the story of the St. Louis and how Canada sent away that boat.
On June 1st, 1984, 70,000 armed service personnel occupied the Punjab. Security forces in the region were granted extraordinary discretionary powers, resulting in anonymous arrests, secret detentions, systematic practices of torture, and the effective dismantling of the judicial system.
First of all, the thing is that if they go back to India, they would, and if they were caught, of course, so the first thing they'll meet is the Indian government, which means they'll put hands on it. So they have no way to escape the consequences of their previous past, I would say. You know, most likely they'll be harmed if they go back, just because they have nowhere to hide. And second, there must have been some evidence against them for actions against the state, I would say.
The Indian government used the conflict as political leverage, painting all Sikhs as terrorists and justifying their actions in the Punjab as necessary to the unity of the nation. By refusing to accommodate Sikhs and their limited demand for regional autonomy, India's central government helped to fuel Sikh militarism. When a minority of militant Sikh separatists took action, the Indian military lay siege to Sikhism's holiest shrine, the Harmandir Sahib, known to most as the Golden Temple. In retaliation, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her Sikh bodyguards, inciting even more anti-Sikh violence, in which more than 4,000 Sikhs were killed.
After 17 days at Stadacona, most of the passengers of the Amelie were released from detention. Six of the refugees were held back as possible security risks, but eventually it was determined that there was no evidence that they had ever committed violence in either India or Canada. By August 10th, all the refugees were released.
We argued on each individual one, the background of the individual. We didn't have to get into initially the issue of their fear of persecution under the refugee system. That came later. And ultimately, after many hearings, we got everybody released.
Still suspicious of the new arrivals, the Canadian government demanded that bonds be put up as a condition of release for each individual to ensure that the passengers did not skip out on future refugee proceedings. Most of the passengers were sponsored by Sikhs in either Toronto or Vancouver.
The Indian community helped us. He arranged the buses. He arranged the security. Because community person arranged the bond.
My bond, you know, in the Toronto people, then their people don't know who is this guy, right? But their people gave the bond. White guy, Indian guy, all Pakistani guy, they gave the bond. He said, don't send those people back in country, right? I want to help him.
All the passengers, except one who remained with his sponsor in Halifax, were bused to Toronto. From there, some continued on to Vancouver or Calgary.
I'm moving after 20 days because the lawyer said to everybody, have two or three places in Canada, have jobs, like job, in Vancouver, Toronto, but he say, where you want going, immigration sent to over there. That's why I'm choosing, because big city, Toronto, and my sponsor is here. I don't know who is the person, but he come to pick up me in the church, Indian church. That's why he take to me in the other church. But he say, what you need, I provide you. But you going somewhere, you tell me. Because he sponsored me, that's why.
Most of the passengers would have to wait months before they were issued work permits, and longer before their refugee claims were decided. Lacking any financial resources, many spent their first few months living in Sikh temples, where they would clean and do chores in exchange for room and board.
So then I stay here in the temple of 1 year. I set up here now. That time they, you know, like Toronto Star coming every day in the temple, where I go, where I, they ask the interview, right? They ask, you know, they give, you know, like a welfare, you know. I say I don't want welfare, right? I want a job. Yes. Give me the work permit, I want a job.
As the passengers were being released from detention and waiting to set up some semblance of a life in Canada, the government continued to whip itself into a frenzy over the new arrivals. In what was called an act of hysteria on the part of the Canadian government, Parliament was recalled into emergency session that summer to discuss a new piece of legislation, Bill C-84, known as the Deterrence and Detention Bill. C-84 sought to punish claimants who did not possess proper documentation, revoke procedural rights for refugee claimants, and introduce harsher punishments for human smugglers. In addition, the bill would increase the immigration minister's unilateral decision-making power to deny claimants on the basis of security or because they were suspected of being false claimants. In order to justify the bill, the government worked hard to delegitimize the Emily migrants, portraying them as unlawfully trying to jump the queue. As Sharman Rahman, a law student at Osgoode Hall Law School at York University, explains, queue jumping is little more than rhetoric used to discredit refugee claimants.
The other thing to understand is that there's really no such thing as queue jumping. You arrive and you get a refugee hearing based on a number of different factors. It could be on the country that you're from, whether or not you're in detention, whether or not you're in detention with children, whether or not there's security issues, whether or not that you've got community support. There's a number of different issues. So that queue jumping idea, it doesn't really come into play as often as people might expect.
Because of the language of queue jumping that was so often used to discredit the passengers, some immigrants to Canada embroiled in family reunification processes believed that the passengers aboard the Emily were being let into the country ahead of their own family members, and urged the government to send the migrants back to India. Immigration processes are distinct from refugee processes, however, and people regularly and legally declare their intention to apply for refugee status once already on Canadian soil. In other words, no queue exists to be jumped.
To be an asylum seeker is to be someone who seeks sanctuary. That's it. It's not prescribed that you be someone who seeks sanctuary by plane or someone who manages to drive over the border. That's not a factor in this at all. The only deciding factor is whether or not you fear for your life, whether or not you fear that you're going to be persecuted.
Although the so-called irregular arrivals are frequently dismissed as queue jumpers, the reality is that migration by boat is often a sign of desperation. It indicates the migrants' urgent need to escape a dangerous situation.
The journeys that they take, the boats that these people come on, they're not safe journeys. It's not an easy choice for anybody to make, especially if you're traveling with your family, to be on these boats. I mean, there's hundreds of people on a boat that may actually only be suitable for 50. These are very, very dangerous journeys, and the dangers are well known and they're well publicized. So I don't think that anybody's under the impression that once they start this, it'll mm-hmm. be a free ride or it'll be convenient in any sense of the word.
The actions of groups like the Coalition for a Just Refugee and Immigration Policy prevented the worst aspects of Bill C-55 and C-84 from being adopted during the Mulroney government, although many of these policies would eventually be reintroduced.
The funny thing is, while the Coalition, in the end, I think was quite successful in stopping the changes from happening when the Mulroney government was in power, after the Mulroney government was, I guess they lost the election, the Liberals came in, and they brought about the exact same thing that the Conservatives tried to do. For instance, like, you know, sort of the safe third country is now law in Canada, and it really doesn't matter which government brought it in. It was something that was considered both by the Liberals and the Conservatives, right? So everything that we fought hard against are now laws in Canada. Promises, promises. Promises, promises. Go back to where you belong. But tell me, where could that be? If this is where I was born. Go back to where you belong. But tell me, where could that be? If this is where I am from.
Although the refugees had now survived the worst of their perilous journey, the next few years were full of more mundane struggles as they made every effort to build their lives in Canada.
Then some people help us get the job in the restaurant in Toronto. That time is $3 per hour. In the restaurant, and I spend 12 to 14 hours every day. Around 1 year, I work over there. Then after I part him, and then weekend, around 2 years, I go over there. A very, very hard work, because I need money, you know. Because back in India, with my family, too many problems.
While trying to learn English and settle into Canadian culture, these refugees were waiting anxiously for the opportunity to bring their families over. It had been years since they had seen their wives and young children, and it would take years still before they were reunited. It took Nirmal Shahal 9 years before he was able to sponsor his family and bring them to Canada.
That time they were waiting in the Punjab, right? They come back here in 93. When we landed, then I sponsor him, my family, then they come back. Very hurt, but they gave.
During the first few years of settling in Canada, the passengers had to deal with parole-like conditions set by the Ministry of Immigration.
Then I go back every week to immigration, lose the time work. Maybe it's whole day I lose because by buses go to in downtown. I sign over there, then I come back to work. That's why I'm face 5 years. I show the paper, then you know thing is unbelievable. Very hard to get the immigration.
It would take years of hard work before most of the Emily migrants had their refugee claims heard and decided.
And then the next step in the process were the refugee claims. And I didn't do all the refugee claims at that time. My job was merely to arrange to have these people released in the ordinary fashion and have their claim processed by the refugee determination system. And that's what ultimately took place. And I arranged for other lawyers to take over because obviously I couldn't handle 174 cases. And it is my understanding, although I can't confirm this, but I have been told that all 174 were ultimately allowed to remain in Canada and were bona fide refugees, so that they have established at that time that they had a fear of persecution because of their race, their religion, their membership in a group, etc., etc., and they were being persecuted.
Despite the hysteria and doubt that accompanied the Emily's arrival, individual consideration of each case established that they were indeed facing persecution in India. Finally, the Emily migrants were recognized as bona fide refugees. After a long struggle to obtain status in Canada, the passengers could now build their lives without fear of deportation.
After 2 or 3 years, I learned driver and placer. After I get the license, then I work to new home. Now I am professional. I have a own company. I work to 3-4 persons, you know, before. Now I am very successful to living, but I believe to, I learned in Canada, I help those people like that, because that time some people help us. That's why I help, believe to help everybody, you know.
Though they now live happily in Canada, the voyage on the Emily and the long and difficult process of gaining refugee status undoubtedly took its toll on the refugees.
But now I have no problem, anything, you know, but I can't forget past time, you know, because it's very, very difficulty I face on my body, you know, and in my mind.
The hardships faced by the refugees aboard the Emily upon their arrival in this country go a long way to dispelling the myth of a welcoming, multicultural Canada, even if their story is ultimately a happy one. Many of the debates about refugee policy that came to the fore throughout the late 80s and with the arrival of the Emily only intensified in the coming years. A growing emphasis on securing Canada's borders reached its pinnacle in the years following 9/11. National security has now become the chief concern for Canadian immigration policy. Coupled with an agenda of economic austerity pushed by conservative governments, the first decade of the new millennium has seen the more draconian policy strains in refugee policy introduced in the 80s reemerge with alarming strength. In 2009, a boat known as the Ocean Lady arrived on the west coast, carrying 76 Tamil migrants fleeing Sri Lanka. In late summer 2010, another 492 Tamil migrants arrived on board the MV Sunsea. Both groups of migrants were held in a detention facility in Vancouver for months before being released and allowed to file claims for refugee status. Like the Sikh arrivals decades earlier, these Tamil migrants arrived in Canada to find a conservative government, a backlogged refugee determination system, and an economic recession. This time, the government is less able to justify its actions against the migrants on the basis that they are false claimants.
But now let's jump ahead till today, to Vancouver, where we have Tamils. Are you aware that before the Tamils arrived in Vancouver in the year 2010, there were a number of Tamil cases before our refugee determination courts in Canada, the Immigration Appeal Division, Refugee Division, and 80% of those cases were accepted as refugees. So, who's crazy?
The reality of persecution faced by the Tamil refugees did not prevent the government from attempting to cast them as illegal queue jumpers. Though their refugee claims could not be denied outright, officials tried to delegitimize the Tamil migrants by associating them with human trafficking rings and terrorist organizations.
Jason Kenney, with the Tamil refugees, started to use the word queue jumper in a very different way. He was now saying that these queue jumpers, and he couldn't avoid the fact that with a 74% acceptance rate of Tamil refugees in 2009, that he couldn't pretend that a lot of them didn't have viable claims. So he started talking about queue jumpers as the good refugees go to refugee camps. The questionable or the bad refugees, the queue-jumping refugees, jump the refugee queue. And once again, I mean, that is so misleading, it is mind-boggling. If you or I escaped from our country because we had fear for our lives and we had a choice with our families, we either go to a hellhole of a refugee camp, and most of them are, and we know we're going to be there for approximately 15, 18 years before we have any hope of being resettled in a country like Canada, or we could find some way to pay someone to get us to Canada. Who in their right mind wouldn't do that?
Part of the government's preemptive campaign was an increased focus on the buzzwords of human smuggling and human trafficking. By focusing on the extra-legal nature of their voyage, the government campaign has had success in criminalizing refugees in the eyes of the public.
Before the boat even arrived, 10 days before, the Vic Taves, who's the Minister of Public Safety, made announcements in the press. First of all, the boat is coming, the boat is coming, and he repeated the following themes: Tamil taggers, terrorists, human smugglers, and human traffickers. And he repeated those. He couldn't say phony refugees because, in actuality, there would be no justification for doing that. But what he did not talk about was all the other facts that were equally as likely true and possibly even more likely, that there were a significant number of those people that had been traumatized during the Civil War, and they'd just undergone a voyage of approximately 2 months. And of course, there were, I think, about 40 children on the boat. I forget how many women, but a significant number, I think in 70 or 80. So essentially, there were potential torture victims, traumatized people. There was no mention of that at all. And in a way, what the government did was they created a public relations campaign. And the campaign was very successful. So the perception of the Canadian public of the claimants on the boat before it even arrived in Vancouver was extremely negative.
That kind of sentiment, like, you know, the anti-immigrant or anti-refugee sentiment, it comes and goes. Like, you know, sometimes it's more prominent than others. It tends to be more prominent, I think, in economic downturn when we have a recession. Then the first group that we tend to blame will be immigrants. And every time there's something, like, you know, sort of like a boatload of people arrive on our shore, then, you know, we go back to our, you know, sort of like, you know, sort of like, we don't want refugees here kind of mentality. So it's very easy to trigger xenophobic sentiment among Canadians, unfortunately. And you kind of have to question, like, if it's that easy to trigger that kind of sentiment, then is it fair to say that we've all, you know, that we were better people than we thought we were?
For the current Conservative government, these refugees provided an opportunity to justify an outrageous new piece of legislation, the Preventing Human Smugglers from Abusing Canada's Immigration System Act, which was first introduced as Bill C-49 and has recently been re-proposed as Bill C-4. The bill seeks to discourage human smugglers, but also punish the smuggled, and prevent desperate refugees from seeking last resort migration options.
This new system would allow, or would mandate, immigration officers to automatically detain for a year any individuals who came in groups of two or more and who were deemed an irregular arrival. It's not very specified what an irregular arrival is, which is, I think, one of the reasons a lot of people are having trouble with this. Basically, the cutoff really is just that you're in a group of two or more people, and for some reason you're suspicious. Even a refugee claimant who has been accepted as a refugee, as a valid refugee, or a bona fide refugee, they won't be allowed to apply for permanent residence for 5 years. And so they're stuck in limbo, because the Canadian government has said, we believe that you can't go back to your home country, and yet they're barring these same individuals from making any progress in Canada for 5 years. I mean, they can't get a SIN card, they can't, their health coverage will be minimal. It's not the same as you'd get as a permanent resident. They obviously are that much farther away from citizenship, that much farther away from voting, that much farther away from really being able to integrate into the Canadian community at large.
If they designate these people foreign nationals, an immigration officer can just say, oh, well, we can keep you for a year without a hearing. Wow. Sounds like Guantanamo Bay. Okay? They can say now that if that person makes a refugee claim, they can't apply for permanent residence for 5 years after the determination of their refugee claim. Why? What sense is there in that?
By punishing so-called irregular arrivals, the C-4 legislation effectively creates two classes of refugees: those who can afford to come by plane or through regular channels, and those who cannot. More often than not, the irregular arrivals are poor people of color from less developed countries. We can suspect that the concern about boat people is less about controlling the number of migrants and more about controlling the type of migrants that are given access to Canada.
Canada's history when it comes to immigration law has never really been that, I guess, stellar a record. And it, historically, it had everything to do with race. And I think today, I think race still plays a big role in it. Although I think it is harder to unpack it sometimes, partly because it is, you know, in general, I think that Canadians, because we have that very positive, though unfounded, view about our country. So, you know, we don't tend to see ourselves as a society where racism still exists. The effect of the laws that we pass today and the policies that we pass still have a disproportionate impact on certain groups. If you look at the people who are coming in Canada into Canada today, I guess what you may call the quote-unquote irregular migration is still coming from the so-called, you know, developing world countries with primarily racialized population. So even though on paper, we don't have policy that openly discriminate against groups based on race, the adverse impact on those policies are still being experienced and being borne by communities of color.
Land of dreams, come and be free, free, free. Raise your families, promises, 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 promises.
Let's review the history. After the arrival of the Komagata Maru, the Canadian government invoked continuous journey laws, mandating that boats from India make a continuous voyage to Canada. Since there was no way to make the journey without stopping, this was a surreptitious way to ban Indian migration. After the St. Louis arrived in 1939, the Canadian government stated that their unofficial policy towards Jewish refugees was that none was too many. And today, the passengers of the Ocean Lady and MV Sunsea face hostility and harassment. Like the Sikh passengers of the Amelie, they continue to be used in the media and by politicians as symbols of Canada's quote-unquote refugee problem. For a country that celebrates itself as a nation of immigrants, this is a sorry history. We tell the story of the Amelie to humanize those migrants. Too often, these stories get lost or co-opted, drowned out by official narratives and politicized rhetoric. Despite the tremendous courage of the Amelie boat people and the compassion of the people of Charlesville, what happened in 1987 sadly reinforces a despicable trend in Canada's attitude towards refugees. By using post-9/11 security justifications, today's government has proposed draconian policies that would never have been accepted in the 1980s, and that increasingly recall the more overtly racist and exclusionary policies of the early 20th century. As we conclude our documentary, we must wonder, is Canada again going to let xenophobia and hysteria determine our policy towards refugees? As war and economic hardship and disaster continue to displace people from their homes, how long before Canada has again determined that none is too many?